Hello, blogging heads, viewers. It's Eli Lake. I'm joined with my friend Matt Duss from the Center for American Progress and the blog. What is the blog called again? I forget the Wonk Room.
The Wonk Room, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I do read it. I read it.
And the Think Progress family of blogs.
It's the Think Progress family of blogs. Okay. Well, it is a snow day in Washington, and a lot of the city is shut down.
Yes.
But we are we can still manage to do this because of modern technology. So let's start off talking about February 11th, the anniversary of the revolution.
Yes.
31 years, and it looks like the Islamic Revolution has run its course. It is spent in the grand scheme of things.
I don't know. Again, I guess that's our first point of a little disagreement right there. I mean, I'm not sure it's clear that it is spent. I think we've seen a lot of evidence that members of the Green Movement, not all of the Green Movement, it is a pretty diverse movement, but certainly the elite factions of the Green Movement are contesting the legacy of the revolution, not so much superseding it.
Yeah, I think that people would... I mean, I think you're right. I mean, in the politics of Iran, it is true that you don't see people saying that they wish the Shah was back, certainly. But in the sense that the kind of revolutionary structures of the government, the supreme leader, and the idea of the guardianship of jurisprudence, mm-hmm. which really has neutered the Iranian democracy, mm-hmm. asserting the power of the Majlis, the power in some ways of the presidency, even though they contend the June 12th election was stolen, mm-hmm. for the presidency. In all of those respects, I think the experiment of having an Islamic republic as opposed to just a republic, if you're Iran, has been spent. The Islamic...
Okay, I don't know. I agree with a lot of what you said there, but I think if you're looking at someone like Montazeri, or now that Montazeri has passed, Ayatollah Sana'i, who seems to be one of his more likely successors, I don't know that they would quite agree that they are no longer interested in an Islamic Republic. I think you need to de-link the idea of Islamic Republic with Vilayat-e-Faqih. I think you definitely need to do that. I think the system, the guardianship of the jurisprudent, I think, has clearly failed.
We agree.
Okay. I think at some point we should get into, maybe we can do this right now. Last week there was an event at the New America Foundation, a discussion led by Flint Leverett that looked at some poll numbers by World Opinion, worldopinion.org, I'm maybe getting that wrong, we can link to it. It was a pretty contentious discussion. I mean, some of these poll numbers, Steve Kull is the pollster who conducted these telephone polls from outside of Iran, calling into Iran, and his information showed that a pretty substantial majority of Iranians, around 60%, believe that Ahmadinejad was fairly elected, and are not really... all of this indicated that the Islamic Republic and the regime as it is now still enjoys pretty solid support in Iran. Now, I'm not... You know, I think polls, even in any country, are challengeable, especially in a situation like Iran, where you're dealing, you know, more or less with a police state. But I think, you know, it's worth considering. I mean, in all situations like that, we really have to examine how much we really know about what Iranians themselves feel, as much as you and I both, I think, identify and support the values of the Green Movement, such as we understand them, more democracy, more human rights. But anyway, what's your take on that?
How much does Flint Leverett really know? You know what I mean? I mean, listen, I don't trust a poll in a country where you have these temporary prisons where people are raped and tortured, where the government is listening to this telephone conversations thanks to the Siemens, the Nokia Siemens network,
which you reported,
which I broke, and more importantly, and everybody knows it. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like, so it's not a secret to Iranians that they're being spied upon.
Right.
It's not a secret about the efforts that the state has taken to try to single out who they believe to be protest or demonstration leaders, and that in this climate of fear, a surprise, you know, Flint Leverett is trumpeting a poll that suggests that people accept the election of Ahmadinejad, a position, by the way, he had taken publicly and forcefully mm-hmm. before he had this wonderful data. And, I mean, the only other point I would make about this is that the Leverets have gone out of their way since June 12 to try to depict the Green Movement as not having a popular base and representing mm-hmm. only kind of an elite in North Tehran.
Right.
And they have been contradicted by many other sources of information, which we both know, that suggest there is more that this movement has more of a popular support than the Leverets are saying. So I take the poll in that perspective.
Right, and I would agree with you there. I think even granting the poll, I think there's really, we've seen hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of
yeah.
not only Tehran but other cities around Iran. And at the very least, even granting the poll, this is a very vibrant civil rights movement. The
yeah.
American civil rights movement started very small. It took a long time to build, and even granting that poll, that's what we have here. Now, again, I would agree with you that we need to be skeptical about this. But I think it is useful in just, I mean, you asked how does Flint Leverett know, and I think that's a totally appropriate question, but I think we need to continually ask ourselves, how do we know?
That's a very good point, Matt. You know, can I just point something out to the viewers? Matt Duss and I, on Twitter and in emails, have been a little bit, but, you know, listen, people on different sides of the issue can come together and have a fair and open-minded conversation. I just want to point that as an aside.
It's true.
We have had some heated moments. But I agree. We should always sort of say what we know. And I would, you know, for the most part, I would say I don't trust people who can tell me, you know, to a precinct how the election went down.
Right.
I think that's very difficult yeah. information to know. What we do know is we have photographs, we have lots of different kinds mm-hmm. of evidence that point to the fact that you have demonstrations in Iran we haven't seen since 78 and 79 when there was an Islamic revolution.
Right.
And every time there is a state-sponsored sort of an official holiday now, there
right.
is another protest,
right.
despite the fact that the Supreme Leader has said explicitly, if you come out and protest these elections,
right.
then we're going to come after you.
Right,
so,
and now with the regime afraid to show
right.
these demonstrations on television. I mean, the first time, I think it was a
yeah.
Quds Day. It was the first time in 30 years that the Quds Day celebrations were not broadcast on state television. Why? Because they were hijacked by the Greens.
Exactly. So that says something to me. That tells
mm-hmm.
me that, you know, I want to go back to a kind of a Marxist friend of mine named Danny Postel out of Chicago. Are you familiar with Danny's work, Matt, at all?
I am not.
All right. You know, we will do a link
okay.
on the side here, because he's written a book that I would hope more progressives would read, and I would hope more conservatives and more moderates or whatever would read, be called Reading Legitimation Crisis in Iran, which is, he actually interviewed a lot of the oppositionists in 2005 and 2006 and was able to, I think, really kind of come and sort of spot a trend that those of us paying attention, you know, to the opposition, which is that there was already at the elite level, probably beginning in 99 and certainly throughout the last decade, a legitimation crisis for the government, which is that they were mm-hmm. losing a sense that they had a right to kind of make the decisions and rule the way they were ruling. And I think that what we're seeing now is that sense that was there in the elite that Akbar Ganji talked about in 2005, which is
mm-hmm.
that the universities are already there, has spread
yeah.
to other segments of the society, as it almost usually always does, which
mm-hmm.
is that if you look at Iranian history, kind of usually these things start in the universities among the kind of academic elite, and then they spread and they filter out to the rest of the society, and I think that's what we've been seeing. Let's hope.
Right. No, I think that's right. So we're getting ready on Thursday's February 11th. It's the anniversary of the revolution.
Yeah.
I think, reported today, Khamenei has threatened some kind of display of power, either directed at the demonstrators, certainly, but also kind of indicating that it would be directed toward Western powers for their interference and their threats against Iran. So, you know, we should be prepared for another crackdown, and I think the joint U.S.-EU statement that was released yesterday was excellent. I think
yeah.
that's exactly the kind of thing that we need to see more of.
Well, we also have the we have some sort of threat to the arrogant Western powers from Iran. I mean, which is deliberately vague.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to speculate as to what it was, mm-hmm. but or what it is. I would want to, if I could point out something here, though, is that
mm-hmm.
I mean, you have an Obama administration, which I think we would both say has bent over backwards to change the tone of the U.S.-Iran dynamic
mm-hmm. yeah.
to make it very clear that it's interested and willing and to engage and to negotiate over the nuclear mm-hmm. program,
mm-hmm.
to do the sorts of steps that I think when Democrats were out of power in the executive branch accused Bush of not taking with Iran.
Yeah.
It's done all of these things, and Iran's behavior in any meaningful sense, Matt, has not changed. Would you agree with that?
No, I would agree with that, but again, I'm not. I think it really misses a lot to simply say that engagement has failed. Let's move to the next step. I think this engagement has shown a lot of benefits. There's the international. We've created an amount international unity that simply did not exist under Bush, and I think we can't really underestimate the effect that our having removed this tool, this propaganda tool, from the hands of the hardliners has done for Iranians themselves. I mean, a good way to look at it, I think, is that the Green Movement is currently competing with elements of the regime for the allegiance of, I think, the great mass of Iranians. They are making a pitch to the Iranian people saying that we represent the true aspirations of Iran. Now, having dialed down having kind of lowered the temperature of the U.S.-Iran relationship, having taken a much more conciliatory approach, I think President Obama has really helped this movement make that case to say, you know, the problem is not out there. It's not this interventionist West that's going to attack us. It is these hardliners who have run our country into the ground. So I think you can, it's really hard to quantify how much that has actually helped, but I think it's something that should be understood.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't necessarily saying. I mean, first of all, I would say that at this point, I think because I care about the opposition, and I think the opposition has a chance, is in a contest to change the regime, to change the system in Iran. I don't think that they would call it a revolution, but there certainly is a contest for power in a way that there hasn't been mm-hmm. in Iran since maybe the dawn of the reform movement. And mm-hmm. Because I want to see Iran in that direction, I would hate to see any kind of diplomatic deal at this point with the Ahmadinejad, Khamenei, Vahidi government, just because it would such a deal would likely empower in that, if you believe there is a contest for the great Iranian masses, that would benefit the side that I think is sort of irredeemably rogue. Or rogue, irredeemably rogue state. So, the dynamics internal to Iran are such that I would not want to deal with this government. And also because I don't think that this government in Iran currently is trustworthy to make a deal.
Yeah.
And I mean, just to say that, they say all kinds of things and they renege on their agreements all the time. So,
If I could just respond to that, yeah. I think. All of these things, and there's a lot that I agree with in there, but all of these things that you just said about Iran, they're untrustworthy, they don't have legitimacy, they're hated by their own people, they can't be trusted to follow through on their agreements. These things were all said about the Soviet Union. I think an example of here of something that could work, and you and I have discussed this before, is something along the lines of Helsinki, which in the short term, and immediately after the Helsinki Agreement, took place, you had a lot of people on the right declaring it to be that we had betrayed these movements in the Soviet bloc by giving the Soviet Union these security guarantees. But in the long term, we saw that this helped to create the space for a lot of these anti-communist dissident movements to really break open their societies and prepare them, prepare these different countries for democracy. So I think...
Well, Helsinki had a third basket. And it mm-hmm. was neglected. The third basket was neglected under the superior statecraft of Zbigniew Brzezinski mm-hmm. and Cyrus Vance. And mm-hmm. then the American people elected a guy named Ronald Reagan, and Max Kampelman was told to deal with the third basket, the democracy and human rights, with the Soviet mm-hmm. Union. And that's when the U.S. began becoming the advocates for political prisoners, not just in the gulags in the Soviet Union, but also in Eastern Europe. And it was combined with a robust sort of democracy promotion, the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy. And at the time, there was a strain of criticism on the left, which was that these some of these actions or these public statements from Reagan, such as the Evil Empire speech, mm-hmm. were deliberately provocative, would start World War III, and so forth. And then we learn later, obviously, when the Soviet Union falls, thank God, and we talk to these dissidents that they say, well, it was really great when Reagan said these things because I knew, you know, it meant that, you know, the treatment of me mattered for something that the Soviets cared about, whereas if I was forgotten, it wouldn't work. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that that model of having the U.S. president become the sort of vocal advocate for the political prisoners in a closed system is always going to work. Akbar Ganji famously said, I don't want Bush, you know, mm-hmm. out there out in front of us because it only hurts us. So, you know, there are people who have different views on this. I don't think, by the way, Akbar Ganji has a monopoly of wisdom on these questions, but mm-hmm. he's an important voice, certainly, as right. a sort of former revolutionary, much like Mousavi. I mean, let me slow down. Do you have anything you want to say to that?
Oh no, I think that's a fair point, but I also think that you left out in your kind of iteration of mm-hmm. Reagan's behavior, you left out the second term where he said, okay, we're going to sit down and talk to the Soviets, yeah. and for which he was excoriated again by the right as, quote, a traitor to anti-communism.
Well, so I know I'm very familiar with this story. Jacob Halvorsen put it in his book on the neocons, and I mean, I would just point out that neoconservative hero Richard Perle is mm-hmm. in Reykjavik with Reagan mm-hmm. and telling him, Ronnie, don't take the deal. This Gorbachev guy, he's going to fall. Like, you know, I mean, there's a couple things going on there, which is to say that, yes, it's true that Commentary magazine blasted him for even deigning to meet with Gorbachev. Right. But then there was another element of the conservatives, the neocons in the Reagan administration who were there, who Reagan ultimately agreed with them and saying, like, okay, well, we're not really going to sign over the farm, and because they were concerned, they did not want to prolong
okay.
the reign of.
Okay,
Gorbachev.
So what we okay, so basically we agree that yeah. the story of the end of the Soviet Union is a lot more complex than making a speech and building some
yeah.
missiles. Okay, so this gets back to my point. I think right now, as we saw in a couple of, we saw this Newsweek op-ed by Richard Haass,
yes.
where he talked about, he posited the choices as between realism and regime change, and I think that's a very, very simplistic rendering of the situation. Frankly, I think we need something that's a little bit of both. I agree, and I've never agreed with the characterization that Robert Kagan made right after June 12th, that Obama just wanted the Greens to go away so he could make his deal. I've always thought that that's just ridiculous and, frankly, a little bit offensive. I think Obama has recognized that his place is not to be at the front of the parade. So we've seen him, you know, ramp up his criticism and his condemnation of the violence as we've gone along, and I think that's appropriate. But I think it's clear right now that any deal, in the event that we actually get to a nuclear deal, which I think seems quite unlikely at this point for a number of reasons, both because I don't know if the hardliners really want one at this point, or if they could even get one given the criticism that would come from people like Mousavi. But in the event that we did arrive at a deal, I think you have to make human rights an element of that deal. I don't know what kind of monitoring regime you would have in for that. Some kind of, you know, an Iranian version of the Helsinki watch. I don't know. But I think any deal, I think Iranians are afraid, rightly, that, if, you know, they have examples in the past of the U.S. treating the Iranian people and other people in the Middle East as just tools of their statecraft. And they always look to the Iran-Iraq war, where we were happy to sit back and help Saddam fight this war that killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Iranians.
Yeah, and
part
sell
of
the Iranians TOW missiles to repel Saddam.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
In exchange
right.
for the release of hostages in Lebanon.
Right. All of which to say that they have a lot of things to point to say that we have played the Middle East very cynically in the past. So I think
yes.
if we...
I'm
if
opposed
we get
to offshore balancing. By the way, that is offshore balancing. And mm-hmm. if you want a little history on who came up with this, sort of who perfected the theory of offshore balancing,
yes.
it would be our friends Walton Mearsheimer, whose new theories about APAC are also problematic.
No, I don't think they came up with offshore balancing. My friend Rob Farley is really gonna scold me because I can't remember the guy who actually came up with it. But
Mearsheimer's book on the tragedy of great power politics mm-hmm. spends an awful lot of time refining the concept.
Right. Well,
Carl
okay.
Starkey
I mean,
would be good for this conversation. I just did a dialogue with him last week, mm-hmm. and And, like, he can, off the top of his head, kind of give you the sort of history of complex IR concepts.
Yes.
If there was a way to three-way conference call Farrell Snarkly into this conversation, now would be a great time for, like, a five-minute Snarkly cameo.
Yeah. Anyway. I think what we need is a kind of Mystery Science Theater Robert Farley down in the bottom of the screen making comments about...
Yes, we do. We need a... And like, because it's not just... He could explain, like, the history of offshore balancing, but he could also explain, like, a lot of other kind of IR concepts. Anyway, mm-hmm. just throwing that out there. You can read them as Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Yes. So just get back to kind of quickly finish up my point. I think, I don't think it's wise to abandon engagement right now. I don't think it's wise to, because I think keeping the hand extended keeps the onus on the regime in a way that I think is very important. It keeps them off balance. And in the event that we do get closer to a deal, I think that the key is to say that human rights should be part of that deal.
Yeah, well, I think we should offer, like, the deal in that movie True Romance, where, like, he offers the guy, the pimp, the envelope, and it has nothing in it. And he's like, and that's our deal. Yeah. Free Iran now, motherfucker! Anyway, like, anyway, I don't, you know,
a more classic version of that would be, I have your answer right now, Senator. My offer is this. Nothing.
Yes. Right. I just sort of, I think that we run the risk of, you do not, I mean, first of all, it's very interesting. The Greens opposed a nuclear deal in the fall on the grounds that they didn't want the government to take credit for, you know, kind of fixing relations with the West. So... I think that has been true.
And the
Greens have also kind of said that it's hard to find out. It's a diverse movement, but the one thing they've kind of consistently said is we want more open and explicit support from Western governments. Or at least moral support.
They said what?
They want more moral support. And the one they've also said, no deal with the coup d'etat regime is what their position is.
Mm-hmm. And, right, I think that's fair. They've said that. But again, I mean, we need to take those ideas into account. We certainly need to give respect to what they're trying to do. But I think it is a question of reconciling our interests and our ideals in the most responsible way.
Okay, but Matt, if I may, there was a time when lots of people, like my wonderful ex-editor Barbara Slavin, were in favor of an engagement approach because, you know, there was a sense that, well, you know, Rafsanjani is a son of a bitch, but he's a pragmatist, or, you know, you can go through that. There were moderates in the regime and hardliners in the regime, and that if we were to do a deal, we'd strengthen the moderates because... Okay, but then this great schism happens, and everybody who was, like, a moderate who may have taken a deal is now on the outside, and their relatives are being tortured. Mm-hmm. And so there's no one left to make a deal with. I mean, and I think I don't think that I'm not... Don't take it from crazy... you know, neocon guy, take it, you know, I just think that that's what Haas is saying, that's what a lot of people are kind of coming around to, and the only one who thinks that there's any potential for a deal with the really hardline people left, who clearly do all these provocative things all the time, they're enriching more uranium, they're promising a punch to the arrogant Western powers, I mean, every day another provocation, is Flint Leverett, who I think practices a kind of diplomacy that I would call masochism.
I think you haven't seen evidence that Ahmadinejad himself is in favor of a deal.
Ahmadinejad is a crazy. I mean, I'm just saying, like, yeah, fine. He was in favor, you know, and then it never happens. I'm just saying he's so provocative. I mean, it's like I don't know. As a Jew, I don't want to cut a deal with that guy. Come on.
Okay, I'm not really sure how to respond to that.
Well, what I'm saying, well, you know exactly what I mean. I'm saying someone who has a Holocaust cartoon contest because some German. Some paper in Denmark has a couple Muhammad cartoons, and the winning entry is Hitler sleeping with Anne Frank, saying "Put that in your diary." I don't think that guy is a moderate. Is somebody who is ready to engage in the Western world. I think he's a Jew hater. I think he's got a history of supporting terrorism in Europe. He was in charge of these kinds of operations for the IRGC in the 80s, when we know that Kurdish leaders in Austria, there have been some investigations into that. I just think that this is somebody who's... Everything we know about Ahmadinejad is that he's an extremist, he's a revolutionary, he's a terrorist. And that's not, and I would, and I'm granting the premise that in the grand scheme of the Iranian elite, there are people who would like to engage the West and to try to de-escalate or end the conflict with the United States. Ahmadinejad, I think we could both agree, is not one of those people.
Yeah, I don't agree. I think I've seen evidence that he does want to, he is interested in delivering a deal for precisely the kind of self-glorification purposes that we talked about. Now, whether
why would we
want
to cut a deal with a guy who would claim our deal was a great humiliation for us? I mean, I'm just saying,
there was a time not so long ago
where we would cap people like that. Not saying we should do that now, I'm just saying that there was a time.
There was a time when we would cap people like that?
Not saying we should do that now. I'm just saying that there was a time back in the, you know, cowboy early days of the Cold War when an Ahmadinejad type of figure would disappear.
Really?
Listen, I'm not saying we should... I'm not for lifting the ban on presidential assassinations. He's a head of state. We shouldn't kill him. I'm just saying that he's a kind of typical... He's done so many things, and it's not just his history. It's the foreign policy under Ahmadinejad, which has become so aggressive on the sponsorship and support for terrorism. Almost to the point where it's become mundane, I would say.
Well, right, yeah, no. Iran has been pursuing an asymmetric foreign policy against the United States in the region for a long time. There's no question.
But it has accelerated under Ahmadinejad. Just
as... Now, we can, I suppose we can kind of
just as his crackdown on dissidents have accelerated under Ahmadinejad. It's
right,
because
yes.
He's a
terrorist, and he can't deal with them. We can get indignant about the fact that they haven't fielded a better air force or met our armies on the field, but they're using, you know, the levers that they have to increase their strategic depth in a way that benefits them at a lower cost. Now,
I don't buy that.
What's not to buy?
Well, I'm just saying it's not like if only they had an air force, they wouldn't be terrorists. No, I mean, there's all kinds of weaker powers. I mean, with the exception of the PKK in Turkey... The Kurds have had militias, and they never resort to the kind of tactics of the Iranians. I mean, ditto for all kinds of groups. It's a particular fanaticism, not unique to the Iranians by any stretch. We've seen it certainly in Sri Lanka. We can see it in Gaza. I mean, it's a kind of an approach to warfare which seeks to kill as many civilians as possible and doesn't play by any kind of international standard. And not every weak power that doesn't have access to a air force turns to these techniques. You would agree with that, right?
No, I'd agree with that. But Iran, you know, as an aspiring regional hegemon, is using the means most available to it, and it's actually done a fairly impressive job.
No, but Iran does things that at least undermine the international system or a community of nations that thinks it's outlawed certain sort of things. I mean, the very argument that progressives made against the Bush administration, which is that you allowed waterboarding, which is a form of torture, which we think all responsible nations should agree to outlaw. But, like, Iran, and I'm not comparing the United States to the Iran, and nor should anyone, but I'm saying Iran lives entirely outside of that system. It's not just that it tortures. It's that its way of war is completely outside of any kind of international system. Its way of war is terrorism.
Okay, and so what? I mean, I'm not saying
so
that.
Well, and so what?
I
that's
approve,
a huge,
I
that's a huge dilemma
I
right now
with...
for the world. it's an amazingly huge dilemma because responsible states and big powers, great powers like America, need to anchor an international system that can protect civilians against the scourge of international terrorism. And when you have a state that demands the respect or sovereign equality but also engages in that kind of terrorism, then it undermines the entire international system, which is one of the reasons why one of my more radical ideas for some time has been that as long as Iran, on a number of issues, from proliferation to terrorism to the treatment of their own domestic dissidents to a series of things, as long as they continue to make mock of the international system, then they should not be afforded sovereign respect. They should not be given. They should not be treated like a regular state. We should.
Yeah.
That's,
okay.
That's my
All right. That. I mean, I'm sure that makes you feel good to say that. But what does that really look like in practice, Eli?
Well, what it looks like in practice is to do what, for example, the Canadians did when they sent the Mortazavi, the prosecutor who's responsible, likely for the rape and murder of Zahra Kazemi, the photographer from Toronto. They called on other states to try to arrest this guy. And we can do it, by the way, right now with their defense minister, Vahidi, who's wanted by Interpol. And an Argentine court to explain as a suspect in plotting the Amia Cultural Center bombings. There's a number of people in the Iranian government right now that are wanted by international authorities, and I think you could probably make a good case for Ahmadinejad as well. That would be one thing. I mean, you have a government of criminals.
But that's already going on. There's already an international structure within which that's going on. I'm saying if you're going to take this radical step. If you're going to take this radical step of saying just their sovereignty is forfeit.
Listen, you can't just say their sovereignty. You have to deal with the world as it is. I'm saying figure out ways to empower and embolden an opposition, which I think would be better than the dreck we have now in running the country, and also make it very clear that we can't allow. I mean, it's not just a problem unique to Iran. I mean, North Korea is another example of a country that technically sits at the UN but is undermining the international system. Is a ward of the international state in a lot of ways. It relies on shipments importing free handouts of fuel to a large extent, food. It's terrible to its own population, and it's a rogue proliferator.
I'll just say that it's very difficult, and I think you'd have a very difficult. It's difficult enough for me to take all of this seriously. I think it's much harder for others around the world to take seriously, given what the United States has been engaged in over the past 8 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You can't just kidnapping, torture, rendering.
It's nasty, and I agree with you. It's the network of secret agreements. With countries like Yemen and Pakistan and U.S. intelligence and U.S. military, and not just Pakistan and Yemen, but, go into Africa, and the writ that CENTCOM has in what's called ungoverned spaces, and which continues, by the way, under Obama. And, all of those things are also testing in some ways this international system. But the reason I think that they are testing the international system is because we have a major problem of small networks, small groups being able to do the damage of nation states. And you need to figure out a way to maintain our collective security in the world and prevent these kinds of attacks. And so that requires, at least in this case, the United States to take these kinds of extraordinary actions. I am not comfortable with all of the extraordinary powers of the presidency since 9/11.
Right.
You can read a piece coming out in a major magazine on this. Yes.
This is a good segue to our next.
It's a good segue for it, because I would say that I too am not comfortable with all of these extraordinary powers, and the story of these extraordinary powers coming from one single resolution, pretty much 3 days after 9/11, and has, as best I can tell, you'll read it in a week or so. I'll make sure to read my Twitter feed. Not as best as I can tell, as I can prove that Obama has assumed the same central sort of war powers as well in a war against a terrorist network that has no global boundaries and no end that we know of. So no temporal or geographic limits. This was a problem with Bush's extraordinary powers. It is also a problem with Obama's extraordinary powers, and I would hope that at the end of the Obama presidency, we had a consensus and enduring institutions for how to deal with those extraordinary powers in order to protect, in order to provide collective security for the world against terrorists like the Iranian Quds Force or al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I think my question here, this may be a kind of a cynical rendering, but maybe not. On the one hand, you've got Democrats, and I think as you have recognized too, there have been quite a few on the left. Glenn Greenwald, our friend Adam Serwer, Spencer Ackerman, my friend Ken Goode, my CAP colleague Ken Goode, who have criticized the administration for not dragging their feet in some areas of civil liberties in a way that I don't think you saw in their opposite numbers on the right. Okay, so you've got a left which is criticizing Obama, but then you've got the kind of center left, which is not really going out of its way to call Obama to task on some of these things. But then you've got this right that has basically just adopted torture and indefinite detention as their planks in their platform.
All right. Well, okay. Let me say a couple things, and I will premise this by saying, first of all, because I've been in Twit Foo. Twitter feuds, Twitter arguments, whatever, with Iglesias at... I'm not saying anything about Iglesias right now, but I will say for Adam Serwer, he's recently written some of these things, that Adam has been consistent on mm-hmm. these principles, and I want to recognize that. So, there you go. In my Twitter feed, at one point, I may have sort of kind of gotten on him about it. But anyway, so let's talk about the right on this issue. The right wants to go back to an argument, Matt, that kind of has been glossed over a little bit, which is, and we saw that this week with Mark Thiessen and Iglesias on the Spanish Inquisition, which is that I think what Thiessen wants to say is that there is a category of stuff we could do to terrorists called torture light. And this concept is not unique to Thiessen, it's not unique to the Bush administration, it goes back to the British treatment of the IRA, people they detained in the IRA during their, what was called the Troubles, things like sleep deprivation or waterboarding, which I think that the people on the right want to say are not really the same thing as what would happen to you in, you know, Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge. And that sometimes in dire situations this kind of enhanced interrogation will solicit important information that could save lives. That is, I think, what their argument is. And I'm not quite there. In fact, I'm not there. I would say that's not an argument that I would make. But they're reacting to what they see as sort of an overreaction or a kind of categorical conflation on the part of their critics.
Well, okay, let me just respond to that, too, because I've written a little bit about Thiessen, and I'm actually one of the few people, I think, on the left who has actually read his book.
You read the book?
And I did read the book.
I did not read the book.
And you know, I'm sorry, it's just, the arguments such as they are basically amount to, how could torture not work? But it's also that this isn't torture. Okay, let's deal with that first. I mean, the idea that we've arrived at some special form of waterboarding which is not really torture, I just find to be preposterous. And this is what really kind of annoys me about this, is that so much of his argument is that it's wrong to call this torture, and to call this torture is insulting to the CIA. But the fact is, on September 10th, 2001, there was not a soul alive who would have argued that this is not torture. Okay, we had the Bush administration, which wanted to look into start doing these things, and we had Bybee and you in the Office of Legal Counsel, the OLC, which came up with a number of very strained legal definitions of torture, such that if you kind of held them up and to the side and squinted your eyes, that it was not torture, so therefore we can do this. It's very much, it's hugely important to understand that after that you had Jack Goldsmith come in as head of the OLC and examine these legal findings, and he rescinded them, okay? It is extremely uncommon for a new administration to rescind legal findings of the previous administration. It is unheard of for it to happen within the same administration. So I think this tells us a lot about how shaky these legal definitions and justifications were. So, I mean, just to finish this thought up, I think, listen, if you want to torture, just come out in favor of torture. Spare us this shilly-shallying nonsense about how this isn't really torture, because it's just baloney.
Okay, well, let me in. Like, you're putting me, Blogging Heads loves a debate. I have, on plenty of times, given my arguments against this kind of stuff, in the sense that if you bring it in-house in a secret bureaucracy, then you're never going to get rid of it. And so I have a problem with that. But let me kind of, I'm not trying to pivot, okay, but let me just make the following. All right.
Okay.
Presidents during wars have done terrible and terrible things. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly the internment of Japanese citizens. Certainly, you know, I don't know, expelling members of Congress in the Civil War. You can go back to wars, and as we both know, incredible violations of First Amendment rights during the World War I under Wilson. You know, most of our kind of laws against leaking classified secrets come from that, from Wilson's era. So there's all kinds of examples of presidents during wars taking extraordinary powers that we don't agree with, okay? Also, as I've pointed out in other dialogues, there's all kinds of examples of the U.S. working with allied services before 9/11 that have certainly engaged in torture and other human rights abuses, and they have presented their own problems. And I'm not going to try to get into that right now. What I want to say, and this is going to surprise some of the viewers who are expecting fire-breathing conservatism from the right side of their screen, is that the problem with the GWAD and the extraordinary powers taken after 9/11, again, is that they were taken as part of a war that will last who knows how long. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's not like we're going to cap. We've toppled Al Qaeda. The war is over, and now we can't do enhanced interrogation anymore, or now we can't have military tribunals anymore, and now we can't hold people indefinitely anymore. And as we saw last week, Matt, and we'll link to my story, Dennis Blair asserted that the president had a process, or that there was a process in the intelligence community where you would get special permission, I'm assuming from the president, to target, with a drone, presumably, an American citizen who has joined Al-Qaeda. Is there any court oversight there? Is there any, you know what I'm saying? I mean, like, these are extraordinary powers.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Taken as part of a war with no geographic or temporal boundaries. And that is a really, that's a dangerous proposition. I would hope conservatives and liberals alike would say to themselves, oh my God, what are we going to do about this?
Because I agree, but that's just the point that no conservatives are. There is
I think there's space for
conservatives. No, conservatives are angry about health reform. Conservatives were silent as the Bush administration grabbed all these powers, basically asserted that it wasn't against the law if the president wanted to do it. But now that the president, now that Obama wants to pass health reform, they're afraid of authoritarianism. Okay, that's the modern.
I don't want to get into like a Republicans or Democrats. I mean, you could say Democrats. Like, I don't want to. Anybody can kind of score points. I'm not coming at it from a Republican or a Democrat. I'm just simply saying that Obama has asserted the same kinds of powers as Bush. And even in the cases where Obama has said, we're not going to torture anymore, which, by the way, as you pointed out, Goldsmith pretty much took care of that already. He did so in an executive order, Matt, which means that his successor, or if he decides to change his mind or something like that, under the same resolution in Congress, could change that. And I'm just saying that this is something that we ought to kind of... We should have some sort of way of saying, because I'm not saying the president, or I'm not saying the executive branch shouldn't do things, these sorts of things, because it's a serious national security dilemma. How do you deal with these networks who can do this great damage?
I think that the stuff you're saying, I'm totally with you, man. But I think I have to come back, and I'm not forcing you to answer for Republicans or for conservatives or for anyone other than yourself. Okay. I just want to say that you're right. I mean, this was an executive order. And but how do you get the Congress to change this when you've got two parties and one of them, the Democrats, are kind of like, well, we're not really comfortable with this, but, you know, we're not really sure. And then the other party, the Republicans, are like, we need to torture the fuck out of them.
Well, okay. Well, I mean, maybe bright young conservative journalists writing for The Washington Times and occasionally for The New Republic can get people to sort of start rethinking this sort of thing. And I'm not saying don't. I'm not saying you shouldn't, that I'm not, I mean, I think, I don't know many people who are against the idea that drone strikes. I'm not necessarily saying that I don't want these extraordinary powers in the hands of the president, because I think at this point I would say the threat is high. The threat is worse than I think the intelligence community thought it was a year ago because of the prospects of what are called homegrowns. So, and the other thing, I mean, from a civil liberties perspective, the dirty secret is this. If Obama doesn't practice, as Bush sort of did, perfect homeland security counterterrorism, Matt, and there's an attack, if Abdul Muttalib blows up the plane, then it's going to be even worse from a civil liberties perspective.
Right.
So I'm saying that there needs to be some sort of agreement now, as soon as possible, on sunsetting the extraordinary powers of a president every couple years in a war when we don't know what's going to end. So Congress and the press and the media can get another crack at all this stuff every 2 or 3 years or something like that. Wouldn't you agree with that?
And I think, if we could, I mean, let's talk about one other thing. This morning, I think there was, I think you linked to it, or maybe it was just that you made a comment about Brennan's USA Today op-ed.
And I
responded a bit snarkily, but I think what you raised was a fair point. And I want to discuss that. You said, you know, he basically charged the people with, you know, who are coming out against the administration with helping Al-Qaeda. Now, I mean, there's a couple things I want to say here. I mean, first of all, on one level, I really just don't like that. Because, I mean, this is a democracy. Mm-hmm. We have a lively political debate. And people say all kinds of things, and they should be able to say all kinds of things.
Yeah.
You know, within reason. I mean, there's a place for hyperbole. There's a place for invective. I think we can agree on that. But at the same time, I think we have seen a number of Republican congressmen and other, you know, conservative critics really just going whole hog against the administration when it's become clear over the past couple weeks that they really didn't know what the hell they were talking about. And in fact, even if there were failures with Abdul-Muttalib, as it is clear, there were a number of troubling failures. The administration has actually been dealing with this very responsibly and very effectively subsequently. So,
yeah,
I mean,
I'm glad you brought this up, because there's a couple things I would say. First of all, I'm covering, Brennan is one of the people that I cover, and, you know, I mean, I did a bio on him, and I don't think he's a terrible guy or anything like that, but I would say it's rich that he would come out and make, with an op-ed that accuses, you know, Republicans of fear-mongering because they don't trust the U.S. legal system, when his own administration, probably on his own advice, have a sort of presumed the same kind of extraordinary powers on military commissions and holding people indefinitely that, you know, Bush had. So, I mean, and this is a point that, you know, Ackerman, Serwer, left progressives have pointed out today, that, you know, if that's how you feel, John, then, you know, don't act holier than thou. The other point I would make about Abdul-Muttalib, just a couple things. Point one, the reason that this all started is because of Dennis Blair. A parlor game in Washington among intelligence and national security reporters, as I'm sure you've picked up, is, you know, guessing the date when Blair is going to be Greg Kret. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, when is he leaving? Because he said an extraordinary thing last month before the Homeland Security Committee. He said, well, I mean, it was a mistake. We should have sent him to a high value interrogation group and not read him his Miranda rights. And he also said in this same testimony, the intelligence community was not consulted on what to do, and we should have been consulted about it. So, in some ways, Republicans have followed the lead of Obama's Director of National Intelligence. Point number two on this is that everybody is completely overstating, Republicans and Democrats, how much actionable intelligence you're actually going to get from some poor schlub who is given, you know, PETN sewn into his underwear. I mean, these guys in Al-Qaeda have something called ComSec, communication security. They know that, you know, this guy is basically, he's a martyr, he's a pawn. I mean, somebody like KSM, now there's a guy who knows a lot of information. Right. Someone like Abdul-Muttalib is going to have a very limited amount of information he's going to know. Right. You see what I'm saying?
I know. I totally agree. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it theorized that maybe he was just a probe. You know, he was someone that they kind of trained very quickly and just sent in to test our defenses. I mean, I think another thing that really has, that I think is not, you know, it's been mentioned, I wrote about this, but it really has to be kind of shouted from the hilltops, is that, you know, it's unfortunate that we're not able to act, or that the information given by his father was not acted upon or fed appropriately into the system.
Well, that's before. Yeah.
It's worth pointing out that his father does not come forward if he thinks his son is going to be tortured. Okay.
Yeah,
we don't get the help. We don't get help from his family. I mean, we went over there to you know, we sent FBI agents over there, brought his family back. They're helping him cooperate. They're getting intelligence. We don't get their cooperation if they feel that their son is going to be tortured. They said in that, I believe it was an ABC report from Jake Tapper, where they said, you know, we are cooperating with the FBI because we know that Umar Farouk is going to receive justice. He's going to receive due process, and I think that's a huge credit to the Obama administration right there.
I mean, Matt, if I may, I'm going to make a point here that is uncomfortable. I have not seen any evidence to suggest one way or the other that torturing someone always works, nor have I seen evidence that torturing someone never works.
Mm-hmm.
The vast amount of information on this point about how do you solicit the most information when you've got somebody who can and you're trying to prevent attacks is that it's usually very, very case-specific. And on the question of torture, I think it behooves everybody be against American torturing people. And I am too. I don't want a bureaucracy that tortures mm-hmm. people. Okay? But mm-hmm. then be against it, even though sometimes maybe torture can work. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, I see the point you're making. I know,
and I would never say that torture always works, because in the case of Abdelmutallab, you're absolutely right. The fact that the family knew that this guy was read his rights, had a lawyer, and was going mm-hmm. to face a trial probably was what they needed to know, because he's mm-hmm. still their son. So in order to try to work on him to get him to spill whatever information he's got,
right. And it's what future informers will know when they think through whether to come forward and decide to come forward. I think. You know, I mean, that's a real value of not torturing.
Right. But, except there's something that, you know, if we were to get an Ayman Zawahiri, he would have an enormous amount of information. This is a guy who doesn't have a relative. You know what I'm saying? He's a committed, hardened guy. Right. Now, that doesn't mean I'd say, therefore, you got to torture Ayman Zawahiri. It just means that, like, yeah. be against torture, accepting that sometimes maybe it does work. That's all.
No, I think that's a fair point. But, again, I think we have to clarify here. I think... There are people out there who have been, you know, pushing, I think, a really misleading version of information that we do get from torture. First of all, I think it's very telling that the overwhelming majority of intelligence and interrogation professionals believe that torture just gets you very little of use. And what information of use it does get you is lost amid this kind of soup of all kinds of information. It takes you all kinds of man hours and time to disentangle the bullshit from the truth. So, as Dennis Blair said in another one of his, you know, inconvenient statements in a previous hearing, yes, we have gotten good information, but what people don't really understand is that what good information we got was lost amid all this other stuff that we had to spend time sifting through.
I mean, I'm just... Listen, I mean, the CIA reports suggest, though they don't get into the question of direct causality, that after mm-hmm. being waterboarded for, 67 times or something, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed then, like, you know, began kind of spilling the beans and teaching a course at the CIA on the history of Al-Qaeda. That's not an argument for keeping to... I'm saying be against torture for all of the noble reasons. And it's
right.
more.
No, I agree.
That's
but
all.
Even
I'm
that,
saying I can. I, sure. I think that there are times okay. when it can work and times when it doesn't work.
Okay.
And the
okay.
only
we're
other thing
really
I would say is that in the case of really a ticking time bomb, okay, and this is less having to do probably with the United States and more having to do with a country like Pakistan, which is like mm-hmm. the real life 24. Okay, I'm not. If someone's trying to prevent a terrorist attack and the guy knows where the 5 suicide bombers are or whatever. You know, I think in that situation, almost everybody says, you got to do what you got to do. And we shouldn't, by conceding that point, you got to do what you got to do in that situation, that does not make you a moral monster or the equivalent of the Khmer Rouge.
Okay, but I mean, I think you also have to understand that the whole ticking time bomb scenario is a game invented by people to justify torture. I mean, I don't think it's ever occurred once in the history of the
world. No, but I'm saying in a place in Iraq in 2005 or 2006... In Pakistan, probably even today, when you have multiple mm-hmm. mass casualty plots being planned, and you mm-hmm. were ever lucky enough to get somebody who actually had real information that could prevent those attacks,
right.
maybe that's not exactly a quote-unquote ticking yeah. time bomb, Matt, but it is a situation mm-hmm. that is not unreasonable to think could happen in a place like Pakistan or Iraq, right?
Right.
Or Iraq sure. before, sure. not so much now, but Pakistan, yeah. certainly. And probably other places, I mean, who knows, like, you know, in Sana'a now, Yemen is becoming, you know, pretty awful in a lot of ways. So,
yeah.
I mean, like, there's these are, I mean, that's unfortunately the world we live in. And, you know, I don't envy the White House at this point. I think that they have to do very difficult, they have to do some very difficult things.
Well, just, I think we're coming yeah. to the end yeah. here, but just to kind of get back, again, not to, I mean, I share your concerns, as I said. I mean, how... looking at the political, you know, the political landscape it is as it is right now, I mean, can you game out for me right now how the process by which we create a political, political consensus around limiting the president's war powers?
Yes, I think that you can get, I think Lindsey Graham and John McCain and Joe Lieberman and Susan Collins, I mean, I can think of lots of lawmakers, and, you know, listen, there are going to be people who are going to sort of shout from a partisan perspective. You see it's on the blogs and talk. sometimes in talk radio, and I say this as a listener of the Mark Levin Show. Okay, so don't count me in that situation, but I'm saying that there's sometimes they have to sort of say, that's one thing, okay, but then, you know, serious leaders in Washington, yeah, I think that they can. Mm-hmm. And limiting when I say limiting the president's war powers, I mean just coming up with a durable system for checking them. And yeah. I had a piece that I talked about with Farley, which I sent to you, on the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which is just dealing with mm-hmm. surveillance powers. And, right. like, that's a really good institution. Make sure it's up and running so yeah. that we have checks on the intelligence community. Because, you know, when you have all this power and it operates in secret like this, then there are bound to be abuses. So I just yeah. want... I mean, I guess my principles are as follows. I want there to be oversight inside the intelligence community and inside the executive branch, and oversight in Congress, regular mm. oversight. I want there to be sunsetting of the privileges, so I want to know, like, we're going to redebate this every 3 years or 5 years or whatever we decide. And finally, point number three, and probably the most important, I want accurate public reports on these powers. Let's say what the government's doing, and without sacrificing vital intelligence or sources and methods, as they would say, tell the public, in plain English, what it is that's going on, and then so we can be informed about it. I don't think it's that unreasonable in this environment. I think you could probably get a lot of responsible leaders to kind of basically agree on those three core concepts. And I have to believe that Obama is not... I don't think Obama is a fascist. I think Obama also... He's a law professor. He probably knows these dangers as well. He probably would want that as well.
Well, I can't say... I think those are great principles, so I'm happy to end this dialogue on a point of agreement.
Yes. Well, just, you know, okay, good. And read my piece next week. All right, Matt?
All right, man. Thanks very much.
All right. Happy snow day. Okay.
You too.